Hi, Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf. You know about the subscription economy, but what about the usage economy? Can you define it? Think of a tangible object you own that might have set you back. Do you use it daily? Or how about some of those monthly subscriptions? Are you getting a full return on those costs? My guest is Adam Howitson. He's the author of The Usage Economy. It's a short and readable book on usage-based go-to-market strategies. The Usage Economy with Adam Howitson, that's coming up next on CFO Bookshelf. Again, our guest is Adam Howitson, author of The Usage Economy. He's the president and CEO of Logisense, and Logisense has a very fascinating background, and we will hear about their pivot in a few minutes. I do love reading books where I'm going to learn something brand new. And just because I know about the subscription economy, I still plowed into Adam's book with a very open mind. And I started this conversation with talking about my riding lawnmower. Adam, I have a farm. It's about 20 acres. Person living there, they get to use my little toy. I have a John Deere, I think it's 72-inch mower. So he's the person living there actually does the mowing. It's about 5 hours a week. We do have 20 acres, don't mow the full 20 acres. So we use that mower, or I should say he uses it once a week from April 1st until October 31st. And then it sits from November 1st through March 31st. By the way, price tag of about $7,500, and I pay another $450 per year for annual maintenance. That's my example of poor usage in the usage economy. You actually have maybe a better example of the usage economy in the book. You want to share your example?
There are so many examples, and so poignant nowadays. You know, we're experiencing all kinds of environmental cataclysm. I live in Canada. We had an outrageous wildfire season last year. We're seeing floods. We're seeing, certainly very recently, a huge number of tornadoes, very destructive in the United States. So a lot of impact on the climate as part of our industrialization. And we're seeing economic pressure, I think, in part due to the pandemic, various monetary and fiscal policies. A lot of the world governments fired up their printing presses over the course of the last 5 years, and we are all now left to deal with the repercussions of those actions. And at the confluence of environmental change, climate change, and social and economic pressure on all of us, it is becoming so important that we utilize 100% of the assets that we invest carbon into generating. And that can be everything from a large produced asset, like a very expensive riding lawn mowing tractor for a farm that might get used 20 times in a season,
right,
and sit there for the rest of the time, still requires maintenance. The carbon is sunk on that. It has been manufactured. The presses have been run. The lathes have been spun. And there the asset sits underutilized. So when we think about those use cases, where are we wasting, and why is this confluence of economic change so important to the way that we go forward as a society? We just look at those use cases. The tractor is a great one. Look at, you know, and it might be slightly different nowadays with a great proportion of, in particularly, technology companies who have virtualized and stopped the commute. Is there really something that we are losing by communicating on a video call here without having had to drive 2,000 pounds of metal 50 miles this morning? Are we losing each other's body language and intent? I don't think so. You can see my face. You can see if I'm blowing raspberries at you or not. So 100 cars sitting idle in a parking lot for 100 employees, when really only 10 cars are needed if they're driving 24 hours a day.
Exactly.
Start times, ride sharing, great examples of where we can be better utilizing the assets that we produce as a society. I know even just my personal automobile, I don't drive a whole lot. Our business is right here in town. It's 10 minutes from my home. I've done millions of miles of travel in my lifetime all around the world, and I don't desire to just hop in the car and drive around. As a result, I've got thousands of pounds of metal sitting in the garage doing nothing. And you can really just put your mind to work about how many different classes of assets are produced by humanity that sit there idle for 95, 99% of their lifetimes, but in those moments of need.
I wanted to confirm that you are not throwing raspberries at me in this conversation.
That's right. No tricky questions yet, though, Mark. So I reserve the right on that. There's so many use cases where we could make a better utilization of the assets that we have. And though we may be altruistic and willing to do so as individuals, without all of us taking meaningful action, the impact will remain negligible in achieving, you know, our goals around becoming an efficient sort of society. And how can we then influence large groups of people to behave in the right way, to start seeking economic, commercial, and asset interactions where we're using what we need, we're not taking and wasting? And though an individual person may be altruistically motivated, the people always lose, the economics always win. The only way to assure this change sticks or begins, frankly, in a meaningful way, is to align better economics for businesses around good outcomes for our society, for our planet, for our people, for our economies. And usage-based monetization, what we've coined the usage economy, in logical sense, is one way to do that. And some businesses may be a little bit reticent, thinking that, well, if I only charge for what's used, I'm going to have less revenue. I'm going to have less money. I'm going to have less profit. I'm going to have less, period. And that's just simply not the case.
Right.
And, you know, we can expand on this further, but if you have designed a good go-to-market around usage-based economics, there's no need for you to have a degradation in revenue. In fact, you'll probably see some appreciable benefits like better customer retention, better upselling, if you provide customers with that optionality. So lots of examples where we see that wastage in today's society, but I'm a deep believer that until we get the economics right, we won't force this change en masse, because individual altruistic human beings don't have the individualistic power necessary to make that shift on a societal level. But the companies who provide the services, the products, and the interactions that we rely on for our daily lives do have that power if there is a relevant economic motivation for them to take that action and make that change to a usage-based go-to-market.
I want to back up a little bit. I was looking at your LinkedIn profile this week, and I saw something as I scrolled down. I saw the term pragmatic marketing. I love it. Can you explain pragmatic marketing?
So pragmatic marketing, the Pragmatic Institute is actually an organization that provides training. When I went through and took their certification many, many years ago, it was around the pragmatic product marketing stream. And there's lots of academic approaches to what a good product manager should be doing. And that, you know, voice to market, helping to set the go-to-market strategy for a product, helping to prioritize features, development, and sort of the future strategy of the product, and was able to attend this Pragmatic Institute's course. And I believe that they're still around, which really helped to put a point on what should be the pragmatic day-to-day, week-to-week activities of a product manager to achieve success and to ensure that they're connected with the voice of the customer and that they understand the strategy of the business and how to prescriptively take those things, mash them together, and create effective product strategy over the product that they're managing. But it was an interesting course and an interesting organization to go and learn from.
Adam, I don't ask every author this, their origin story from the book, and you do spell this out early on, LogiSense. What an interesting story. This used to be, correct me if I'm wrong, LogiSense started in 1995, internet service provider, and then they pivoted. And then I'm thinking, okay, here is a CEO who has internalized what we're talking about. You want to take it from there on where this book came from? Am I warm on this?
Yeah, definitely in the right direction. And I won't take credit for that pivot. I'll give that credit to our founder, Flavio Gomes. And Flavio started Logisense as an internet service provider. This was, you know, 25 plus years ago, back when we were hanging racks of dial-up modems on the wall through copper telephony lines. And I don't know if you recall back then, probably a similar demographic to me, but you would pay for the minutes that you had dialed up to use your US robotics modem would sing its song and do its handshake and you would be online. And when I first got started, it was, you know, Gopher and finger protocols, and it was only text and you could search, and it was largely academic and government institutions online at that point in time. But you would dial up to your internet service provider and you would be connected over an acoustic modem. And you had to be able to bill for that. And Flavio started at the time, there weren't a lot of options back then to do a usage-based billing to introduce some of the complexities. Like perhaps you want to have a pool of minutes. Perhaps you want to draw down from those and have multiple contributors. Perhaps you want to offer discounts based on the amount of usage or the amount of minutes that a particular household or client is consuming. And Flavio had the organization develop a billing system that would be able to accommodate that for the dial-up internet service provider service that Logisense provided. As cable, broadband, and the tier one communications carriers started to come in the space, and in the states that would be a Comcast or an AT&T, or, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the standard providers there in Canada, Bell and Rogers started to roll up these small localized internet service providers. Flavio sold off the portion of the business that had the racks of dial-up modems, but realized that there was tremendous value in the usage-based billing system that Logisense was using to commercially interact with its clients, and was in fact getting phone calls from other similar internet service providers all around North America asking if they could get access to Logisense's billing platform. And he realized he had a golden nugget there, and something that would persist not only in dial-up internet service provisioning, but also in any area, voice and cellular providers, at the time, very communication-centric, coming from that ISP lineage, who could all use this capability to differentiate and market. And now it's old hat to us that your cellular plan has got buckets and sharing and pooled contributions, and you pay by the meg or by the gig. There's the concept of overage and usage packets. If you go over your entitlement, you'll get dinged. It'll cost a little extra because you didn't commit upfront. And Flavio realized he had a gem there, and he pivoted the business to become an enterprise software company from an internet service provider, hanging onto the IP and software assets and making that the core focus of the business probably, 15 plus years ago. And that really is the genesis of Logisense as a usage-based billing and monetization provider.
If you don't mind, I want to hit some of the most basic concepts in this book. I think there's about 13, 14 chapters. By the way, I read this in two settings. It's about 130, 140 pages. So this is a very readable, accessible book. I want to start this with a stupid question, if it's okay. I do use a service called bunny.net, and it's where I host videos for some of my websites. And about every 3 months, I have to deposit about $25. It's amazing. It's like super cheap. Even if you're getting 1,000 impressions on these videos, it's really cheap. So here's another $25, and then my meter goes up until it runs down. So then I got to thinking, and you mentioned Netflix early in your book. Does that mean Netflix, the subscription we pay, is that not a usage-based pricing? Are they not part of the usage economy, or are they?
Indeed, it is not, from my perspective. And I love streaming services, and I love my content, and there are some great things out there to watch and some wonderful art. I have got, Mark, so many subscriptions in my household for streaming service. I got the Netflix, I've got the Prime, I've got the Apple TV, I've got the Disney Plus. I got, keep on going down the list. And increasingly, as I think all of us experience this this growing economic pressure, we think, should I really be carrying 6 or 7 different streaming subscriptions just for content? A single human isn't capable of watching all of that.
Right.
Though I proceed at this time to carry them. However, I think the patience is growing short. And I think to myself, the first streaming or first content house streaming provider that comes to market and says, look, we understand that you carry six or seven subscriptions today. We know that you might be off on Apple TV watching Foundation. You might not come back to our service for a month. So we'll tell you what, put a couple of $100 on account with us. And as you consume content, even if you leave it running while you're snoozing on the couch on a Sunday afternoon, or whether you're binge watching the new season of your favorite show, we'll deduct a credit for every hour or minute or second consumed based on what you're actually watching. And if you don't show up for a month, we won't charge you. Your money is still going to be on account with us. I would put that money on deposit with that streaming service and cancel the rest, the first one that comes to market with a true usage-based plan, because then I'm not wasting $400 a year times seven streaming services. I can put $400 on account with each of them, and that might last a couple of years. There's the, you know, and part of why this primer is written in a very accessible way is that I think there's still a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. The $15 a month that I'm getting right now, which may churn due to non-usage, is better, easier, and more predictable for me than having a usage-based sharing or bucket or consumption drawdown plan. Because once I get the deposit, I don't know if I'm going to have $15 a month forever for the next 3 years until the customer churns, because they're upset that they're not getting any value from it. The move to a usage-based plan makes the customer happier because I know that I'm getting value. I'm only being charged for what I'm using, not for a service that I might not fire up at all in that month. For the company, they've already got my money. They have been paid up front. The money is on deposit and I'm consuming it down in the exact same example you provided for your streaming service. And I bet, not to put words in your mouth, that you feel very comfortable with that commercial arrangement and you like that vendor. You don't feel like you're being ripped off. You have controls in place. When you get to the top of the meter, it says, hey, you better top up or we have to decommission the service here. Need another $25. It'll support another 2,500 streams and you'll happily go do that. And you're not thinking about switching with that vendor because it's very fair. The price that you're getting for the value that you receive and the outcome that you want, which is people consuming your podcasts. When that happens for you, you're happy to pay the vendor supplying the service for you.
Yes.
Because an equitable exchange of value has occurred. And I believe that more and more so in both B2B scenarios and in our consumer lives, receiving an equitable exchange for value is going to be the differentiator in the market. And make no mistake, your pricing, your billing, and your commercial interactions are a part of the product. You can send a customer a bill 1,000 times and never hear from them. They'll never respond to one of your marketing emails. They'll never reach out on one of your, you know, pay-per-click campaigns. They'll never buy a second product. But if you send them the wrong bill one time, if you overcharge them one time, if you make a mistake one time in the commercial interaction, you're going to hear from that customer. So getting that right is absolutely imperative. But I digress. On the streaming front, I deeply believe that the first large content streaming house that comes to market with a real usage-based plan is going to, because we are reaching the limits of the human population on planet Earth, the connected human population on planet Earth. Over the last year, for the first time, Netflix has been losing subscribers, and that's been in the news.
Right.
The last 20 years in high technology, you know, a lot of the philosophy has been predicated on this notion of infinite growth. And it doesn't matter how much money you're burning, as long as you're growing and you're growing quickly, everything is going to be fine. All of a sudden, the free money went away 5 years ago. Interest rates came up and that philosophy was no longer valid. The market looks at different things nowadays, your EBITDA, your earnings. Are you sustainable? Can you keep going without money that costs 7 to 10 points to keep the business funded? And we've also reached the limit of how many online human beings there are on planet Earth. So now it's going to become competition within markets for some of these established technologies. I'm still on my streaming service example. So I need to compete. I have to take share from Disney if I'm Netflix. I have to take share from Prime if I'm Netflix. And how can I do that? I can spend billions on creating new original content, which they do today. All of them do that. But can I look at the commercial experience as a part of my product? And can I use that as a point of differentiation? And I'm a deep believer, and hopefully we'll write this down and maybe in a year or two, we'll see one of them make this switch. The first one that offers a unique usage-based pay for what you get, deliver value for every interaction model, is going to start to eat market share from their competitors.
I would pay good money to hear you tell a story. The subscription economy meets the usage economy. I'll throw a couple of other examples other than streaming services. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Economist. I would love to see a survey that shows, let's take the Wall Street Journal. I do look at the headlines every single morning, and then I'll drill down to the articles I want to read. If I'm really, really busy, I may get through a one-week time period where I can't read it. I can't read the New York Times every single day. The Atlantic is the same way. I go through binges. I think it'd be interesting to see a usage economy for online news. Do you think that's crazy?
No, I don't think that's a crazy idea. You know, my experience with the online paywalls, and look, newspapers, journalists have to be paid for their work, right? And particularly those who go out and do the research versus, you know, grabbing AI-generated content or aggregating what comes across from AP and spitting that back out. But those who are investing in journalism, you've got to pay to keep your teams going and to keep producing that original content. For me as a consumer, I shop around online. I don't have one particular favorite publication. I like to consume from sources all over the place. I leave when I hit the paywall, Mark. I leave. I'll find another source that's covering the same topic and I'll see what they have to say. Some of these outlets may have very dedicated subscriber bases. That might absolutely be true. But as you say, I might not go back to the Wall Street Journal for a month and $10, $20 wasted, it's gone. That adds up over time, especially across a multitude of sources. I'll come back to my Netflix example. What if you could put $100 on deposit with the Wall Street Journal and you could read 1,000 articles at your leisure anytime you want? And it's a penny, a fraction of a penny, a few pennies each time you want to consume some of that content.
I love it.
I would be more likely to do that because, you know, those of us who are ambling around and don't necessarily return repeatedly to one individual source. But if I had some dollars on deposit with a multitude, I've got the Economist, I've got, you know, in Canada, maybe the Globe and Mail, I got the Wall Street Journal, I got the New York Times. And once a month I go there, you know, maybe a half a dozen times and read an article, it does a small deduction and I'm never stymied by the paywall. And I know that when I run out of credits, all I need to do is add more credits. I would become a customer of those sites. Today, however, I might only hit one or two of your articles in a month. And if it's paywalled, I'll just leave and find a free source for the same information. Particularly if it's big world news coming across the wire that every outlet is covering, why wouldn't I just go to one that's generating revenue solely on advertising? And then I don't have to encounter the paywall. And it's not necessarily even a monetary thing. Sometimes it's about the experience. I'm going to go through this effort to set up a subscription, enter my payment information. I'll get my card charged. I'll read the one article that I want. Next month, I'm going to have to think about, do I still want this subscription? Or was it just that one article last month that I wanted to read that cost me $20 to read? Versus I go through all of that effort. And now for the next 5 years, I've got credits on deposit with this outlet. And I can go back anytime without having to go through that effort. I don't have to think about maintaining my subscription or my accumulations of subscriptions. In fact, there are services today and financial services applications that will track how many subscriptions you're paying for, because people often forget that they're signed up to things.
Right.
And they're sending money out the door and have no idea what it is. They forgot they had the subscription and that company keeps happily charging them. Well, when they discover that, they're obviously not pleased. And though it wasn't intentional by the vendor who kept charging them for a service they weren't using, that negative experience of, geez, I had that going for a year. I let $300 go out the door. I forgot that I had the subscription. It was never noted to me that my usage was zero. I have a bad taste in my mouth from that experience. It's nothing that they intentionally did, but it was my own neglect that led me to have that experience.
However, and again, I could be wrong. I bet your best customers at Logisense who are using this usage base process of selling, I bet their customers get emails saying, you've not used this. Are you sure? Of course, their bill's not going to show a monthly fee, I'm assuming. But I would just bet that even beforehand, some of your customers were alerting their customers, hey, you haven't been using the service. Whereas, other services, they'll gladly take your monthly ACH or credit card.
We'll be right back.
Are you interested in small businesses? My name is David C. Barnett, and I've been podcasting and producing YouTube videos about buying, selling, financing, and managing small and medium-sized businesses for almost 10 years. I'm a former business broker and have owned and operated several businesses, and I've been advising business owners since the 1990s. Each week, I create a new podcast which answers one of your questions, and I've always got amazing, exciting guests. You can find me on YouTube by going to smallbusinessanddealmakingpodcast.com or just search David Barnett Small Business in any podcasting app to find me. I look forward to seeing you around.
I'll give you one very poignant example, and this is a case study that is online. Anybody can go look this up. It's available publicly, but Garmin, who I think we're all very familiar with, yes, in our day-to-day lives.
Yes.
Very reputable brand, great products and services, renowned in their space. Everything from glassless cockpits to marine navigation to wearable devices, smartwatches, avalanche beacons, you name it. I think we're all familiar with Garmin. When the pandemic happened, and Garmin has been a LogiSense customer for a long time, when the pandemic happened, Garmin was in a position where they knew that their customers wouldn't necessarily be using their devices. National parks were shut down. You couldn't go to a national park. You couldn't go out on your hike. You couldn't go out and engage in your outdoor activities or your, adrenaline sports. And it was going to be locked down for some time, particularly that first summer. Garmin saw what was happening and thought, we're probably going to have a wave of cancellations over the course of this summer because people simply can't, they're not legally allowed to go out to the areas where they would be using these devices. And so they won't be. And Garmin, leveraging the LogiSense platform, was able to introduce something called state-based pricing, where we can move a device or a subscription from an active state to a suspended state to a pandemic break state to a, you can define the states, very complex capability for defining these types of go-to-market motions. And Garmin proactively reached out to their customers and said, we value your business. And we all know in business that it's cost you $7 to acquire a new customer. It costs you a dollar to retain a customer. And having millions of individual consumer customers cancel their subscriptions, go away for some period of months, come back later, have to re-register, reactivate the devices, put in new billing and payment information, sign back up. You're going to lose some given that amount of work. That's a barrier, especially when you're talking about a consumer product and a consumer relationship. And Garmin proactively reached out and said, look, we know that there's a pandemic. We know that you're going to have some diminished utilization over the next little while. We would like to offer you a suspended state for a buck or two a month. We'll change your plan over. We'll keep you active as our customer. Stay in our system. Keep your account live. Don't worry about it. We'll charge you a very minimum fee. Don't terminate your commercial relationship with us. And we'll be here for you when the world regains its senses, when this pandemic is under control. Your business is important to us. So please accept this gesture of goodwill to move you to a suspended state or a pandemic state here on your device and your subscription.
It's minimum integrity. Cost. That's integrity.
It's integrity. And let's get back together post-pandemic, and we hope you start enjoying your devices again. And the amount of goodwill, the amount of customer retention, the amount of benefit Garmin received by leveraging that usage-based, state-based go-to-market capability they had, reaching out proactively to their customers and offering them a true usage-based commercial experience was outstanding. And again, this is available online. You can search for it. You can find it on the LogiSense website to learn more about that specific use case. But that's one where doing the right thing by the vendor ingratiated themselves, provided transparency, flexibility, optionality to their consumer base. And it wasn't an altruistic move by Garmin. Well, I mean, it was, but it was a commercial benefit. It was a real business benefit to retain millions, tens of millions of subscribers in an active commercial state. No canceled or deleted accounts. Nobody left and went out looking for other options. We're just going to switch your state for a few months until we see what's happening in the world. And when we're all ready, we're going to switch it back and let's get outside, get your avalanche beacons on. Let's go skiing. Truly extraordinary example of where you can use this type of monetization model to garner goodwill, to empower your customers, to reduce your churn. And as you say, to be of a high moral fabric when interacting with your customers, to give them a positive experience coming away from you. And Garmin is certainly one of those companies with that high moral fabric. And they got to reap the benefits of taking that action and conducting themselves in that way.
You mention in the book, in the first few chapters, that one of the impediments or one of the barriers to moving to a usage model is the lack of knowledge of the leadership group. Can LogiSense come in and help? I think you can do this. Can you look and study the business model? Because otherwise, where does a leadership team figure out? Because this just doesn't happen overnight. They're not going to say, okay, we're going to go to the usage model. I think they need help, right? Is that correct?
You're exactly right. And that's the intention of this book. We're still early in the adoption curve of these types of plans. Like we said, I'm sitting here with 9 household subscriptions for streaming media. We're not in the bulk adoption point of the technology adoption curve with these usage-based economics yet. And part of the reason why we're starting to move into it is that education is growing around what these terms mean and what usage-based economics are and what the usage economy is. And I think for those of us who've been in the business for decades, who don't have this initial education, this primer around usage-based economics, there's a reticence because there's a feeling like if I can't take every last dollar from every customer, if my revenue isn't highly predictable, I'm going to have an upset CEO because the CEO wants to know what the revenue is going to look like 12 months from now. I'm going to have an upset CFO because the CFO wants to not change any processes. It's working. We pass every audit. We're compliant. Please don't make this difficult for me. But the benefits are starting to become more and more obvious when we see the use cases like Garmin, when we see use cases like Uber, like Airbnb. I mean, the biggest transportation and logistics provider doesn't own a tire. The biggest hotel group doesn't own a brick because you're paying for the outcome, for the experience. It's not the car that you're paying for. I want to get from point A to point B. That's what I care about as the consumer. And the accessibility of the book, meant to be a simple primer for executives, frankly, is to start to take away some of the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that, in fact, you can improve your growth rates by getting customers on board, having them happy with the value that they're getting for their exchange, and empowering them to self-select through self-service portals, through your customer experience processes, to add additional product and services, to make larger commitments up front, and then to be able to draw down from those commitments across all of the products that your company provides. A great example in the B2B world of this is Amazon Web Services. You may, as a software company leader, be asked to commit tens or hundreds of millions of dollars a year in AWS spend to get certain benefits. It's very hard to predict exactly how much compute am I going to use, exactly how much storage am I going to use, exactly how much of service 3, 4, 5, 100 am I going to use. But if the deal instead is, can you commit to an overall commercial interaction of X million, and you can spend it across our portfolio of 60,000 SKUs of 500 different services at your leisure, and the vendor then, A, has some assurance that the contract they're signing, the commitment they're getting from the customer is going to be predictable. The customer feels empowered because now I don't have to spend it exactly on one item. My business may move an inch to the left, an inch to the right. I could consume more of A than Z. I could really have some flexibility, but I have a general sense of what I'm going to spend. It's going to be a little bit more than I spent this year. So I'll agree to do that. And then you let me spend it however I want. I feel good. I got the optionality. I'm going to get value for money. I've spent that much every year for the last 5 years. So fine, here's my commitment. And then I can do it as I please, where the business needs as we go along. So, I'll come back to the question, and apologies for getting off on the tangent there with the examples. But the accessibility is meant to start to educate some of those executives now in power, designing the commercial go-to-markets for their organizations who feel like the opaque, locked-in, take every dollar until they leave approach is better than retaining customers who steadily grow, who are happy with your business, who have loyalty because you treat them fairly. And that, in fact, your business will grow as a result. Your industry will grow as a result. You will retain more customers. You will upsell more. And example, you know, one example that I think everybody is familiar with on the other side of this, where charge them what you can until they pop, cable television. cable television. We reached peak cable television, I think, in 2011, and it's a multi-billion dollar industry that has been going downhill ever since. Because, Mark, the only offer I'm going to accept from you as a consumer is to pay me $5,000 a year for 800 channels that you don't watch so you can get two that you do. And by the way, while you're watching the two that you do, I'm going to pipe in 25 minutes of advertisements for every hour of content you watch. And as a result of that, we all know how that makes us feel as consumers. And 5 or 10 years ago, remember, there was the big cord cutter movement, people moving to streaming services. That was a very nascent industry at the time, cutting their cable cord and saying, I've had it. $20 a month is a good result for me. I get the content that I want, and I'm not paying $5,000 a year for cable television on this opaque, locked in, nowhere to go, like it or lump it approach and being treated like that. I don't accept that as a consumer. So now you got my $20 a month. Well, it's 10 years later now. The subscription economy is old news. The subscription economy is as old as the milkman, the iceman. We're all familiar with that. The next evolution is taking even that $20 a month, and can we further optimize it to drive competition between companies in the market, to demonstrate to consumers that they can have a positive experience, that organizations can be of high integrity and ensuring that their customers get value for the services that were provided, while all the while retaining more customers, while all the while empowering better upselling within their consumer base, and while all the while providing better capital structures, frankly, where you can take money up front and let customers draw from that based on their actual usage of the service. And you as the vendor the whole time have got that cash to use for your business, to invest, to grow, to deal with.
I so badly want DirecTV to be your client because I'm shelling out about $60 a month to them for a lot of channels, for a few that I do like to watch. By the way, you're just described, if you ever need a title for a future talk, the usage economy versus the fear-based economy, because the reason a lot of these other firms are using the old model is based on fear. But hey, one word, I want to hear your definition of a word. When I read nonfiction, I will take note of words and I'll go back and study those words. It's a great way to remember a book or to remember the key points or pillars of a book. When I got done reading your book, one of the words that I typed into my Kindle and I reread every highlight, I'm going to be curious if you're surprised at the word I keyed in. Telemetry. Can I get your definition of telemetry and why that is an important concept, an important word to know in the usage economy?
We'll be right back.
Moving is right up there with death and divorce in the stress Olympics. But fear not. Turn that box of woes into a crate of woes with moving tips in the Life Beyond Boxes podcast with Premium Q Moving. Dive into the world of hassle-free moves, learn tips and tricks to save on cash and your sanity. Say goodbye to those moving meltdowns and hello to the smooth sailings. Or should we say smooth movings? Tune into Life Beyond Boxes with Premium Q Moving on lifebeyondboxes.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. And with us, unpack the secrets to a stress-free move.
Certainly. It's a word we use often in that book. I think now we shift from our consumer mindsets to our business managing enterprise mindsets. There are so many opportunities, and increasingly in our day and age, the information itself is the product. Outside of physical assets, you know, we still need jet engines, we still need locomotives, we still need bridges, we still need roads. But increasingly, the share of our economy that is information based is growing exponentially as technology continues to proliferate. The data generated through usage based commercial markets, because of the way that our platforms work, we have to have the knowledge of all of the events. When did Mark make that phone call? Which hour of content did Mark watch? What was the licensing rate for that hour of content? How many miles did Mark go in the car to get delivered to his destination? All of these things are part of that word, telemetry. It is when you pay your bills. It's when you consume a service. It's when you're looking at content online or selecting and configuring your packages. It's every, think of a network switch if you're monetizing digital connective services. Every byte that goes over the network, where it goes to, which API was called. these systems and businesses that provide these types of technologically enabled products, shipping containers with GPS sensors, warehouses with thermometers, the amount of square footage or the volume that you're consuming, how many kilowatts were consumed. You can, everything has a measure, right? Everything has a measure, and we can measure it now. 20 or 30 years ago, I come from a time when processing power was at a premium. There was no cloud. There was no elastic compute. There was no elastic scaling. There were no serverless operations. That stuff didn't exist. Bandwidth was at a premium. Compute was at a premium. Storage was at a premium. And we didn't have the technical and the compute infrastructure in place to be able to count every event. Because understand, for some large organizations, we're talking about billions or trillions of events a year that are generated within their customer bases. And using the information that is generated around this class of monetization empowers your business tremendously, not only in terms of direct result. I can see who's underutilized on the plan that they paid for. You paid for 10 units this month. You've only used 9 units. My sales team should call you and make sure that you're not at risk of churn. Do you want me to downgrade your package a little bit? I notice that you're wasting $5 a month. Can I help you to make that right so that you're happy with us and remain a customer for the next 20 years? Or maybe you've consumed 100 units and you're only entitled to 10. Hey, Mark, can I sell you a bigger package right now, save you a little bit of money on your next bill, give us a big commitment? Because maybe you don't know this, but you're 10 times over your commitment. And without the telemetry generated by these systems, you would not have those insights. And I'll take it even a step further with the emergence, particularly over the course of the last year, of artificial intelligence. I can't go to ChatGPT, probably the most well-known colloquial example of these generative large language models that is out there today. Everybody knows about ChatGPT. I can't go to ChatGPT and ask it something specific about my business using the public version that has been trained on the information publicly available on the internet, right, or whatever their sources are, which they don't divulge all of them these days. They used to, but they don't anymore. Couldn't go to ChatGPT and say, which of my customers are most likely to churn in the next year and why? What is the revenue of my top 10 customers and which one is growing the fastest? How are my products doing by country, by industry, by growth rate? And could you provide that work today requires, let's say I'm a product manager. We'll go back to that example. I email somebody in finance. They pull some reports out of an OLAP cube. They've got great Excel skills. They've got a pivot table hooked up. They've got a data source. They slice it. They dice it. 15 or 20 minutes later, I get an Excel file back or a CSV file. I can go on with my day as a product manager. But that took two humans an hour of productive time to generate. And I can't get that answer from a public generative large language model today. But if I do some prompt engineering, which is providing extra data along with my query to a large language model AI, or I train the AI model itself, I take the baseline of a ChatGPT, and I start to train it with the telemetry generated by my usage-based monetization infrastructure over the last 3 or 4 years, I can ask it those questions. And we actually do this at LogiSense. We have a solution called RAIL, Real-Time AI Learning, where we will take, transform, and ship relevant information over to a generative large language model to be used by clients to either prompt engineer or retrain the models with the specific economic telemetry of their business to make it possible to ask the question, give me my top 10 customers, my top 10 products by country, by rate, by growth, by you name it. How would you like to slice and dice it? And have the AI respond accurately with that data. What does that mean? I think there is a shortage. And again, I apologize, I'm getting off on a tangent here on telemetry, but there's an end result to this, that what would I do if I had an organization, and LogiSense primarily works with large enterprises, the Garmins, the Cisco Systems, the Vonages, the Five9s of the world. If I have 50,000 employees and it takes half an hour for two employees each to answer one question, to get a report for a product manager to get on with their day today, by 60,000 employees, by 365 days a year, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in lost productivity. If my AI was trained with the telemetry of my commercial engine at the company, and any employee of the company could ask the AI a question to get on with their day, can be completely automated, delivering accurate results with the telemetry generated through these commercial systems. So that's not in a word, but that is my take on telemetry. And it is the vital lifeblood of the future of the way that we economically design and take products to market.
you exceeded expectations on that simple word. I forgot to email this article to you. You probably have read it. AI, the use of AI in exploring data is not new. It may be better or faster, but there's an article in HBR 2017. It is an excellent article. It's about Harley Davidson. They rented, there was a dealership that rented or leased IBM Watson for a weekend, and it went through its CRM to help to determine where can we improve our sales. And it's this great, great article. And it's like, I want more of that. And you just described that through telemetry. Again, this is a fascinating topic. So that word, for any other reader, go back and reread all of the instances of that word in the book. There are at least four intriguing, fascinating, compelling case studies. We can't go through all of them. Probably the first one that's brought up, real quickly, what did Wink get wrong? By the way, this is a great way to teach the usage model, is looking at someone who they didn't do it right. Maybe they didn't have you in their corner. But real quickly, can you describe the Wink model as you brought up in the book and where they went astray?
Absolutely. Well, as you can imagine, a career technologist, I love to geek out in my spare time. And many years ago, started on my home automation endeavor, where I wanted to get all of the light switches, get the heating, get the garage doors, get the locks, get everything onto automation. And at the time, there was an offering in market called Wink. I believe they may still be around. And Wink offered an automation hub that would integrate with all of the different switch manufacturers. It would, send signals over Wi-Fi or over a radio frequency or whatever the devices, the light switches themselves, the garage controllers, et cetera, required. And would become the center of automation around that. And you could design different programs. So with a single flip of a button, you can turn on all the lights, open the doors, draw the bath, you know, et cetera. And at the time, Wink was, this is all supposition by me, but maybe founded by an electrical engineer and not a business person. And they had a brilliant little device. It was $50. I remember I got it at Home Depot at the time, one time sale. And you have this connected hub. In order to configure it and to use the services, however, you needed to go through the internet. And there was a software application created by Wink and a mobile application where you could add switches, create your programs, how many things turn on at once, at what intensity, when does it happen, what's the command to activate them, all of those good things. But Wink's commercial model was to only charge a one-time fee for the hardware that you bought at the hardware store. They had an ongoing cost to carry in this infrastructure that was, in fact, the software, which is the experience with which the customers interacted. The beautiful hardware device, I tucked away in a closet, I never saw it again. But I'd constantly be interacting with the application and what was available online to configure it, to use it, to activate it, to optimize it, to do all of my proverbial geeking out in this home automation project. There was no additional cost, but Wink was carrying the cost of this infrastructure, the cost of development for those applications. And I think that they missed a huge opportunity to implement, and I would happily have paid for, a usage-based monetization model. Perhaps you get the hub for free and you pay for how many devices you're going to connect to it. And you pay for how many times you initiate the hub in the course of a month. Or perhaps you can buy a package in advance to cover you for the year and draw down credits based on how often you turn on the lights, turn them off, add new devices, customize them to create an ongoing revenue stream and not a subscription. I don't want to pay $50 a month to be able to open my blinds. No thanks. I'll walk over and open them myself. But a few pennies, a few tens of pennies to initiate an action each month that draws down against a balance that is irrelevant to me could have created a revenue stream to sustain that online experience, application development, internet infrastructure, and other items that would have been so important for Wink to have revenue streams around, because they had hard costs associated with those. But at the time that I had interacted with them and was a consumer of theirs, there was only the one-time point of sale monetization around the hardware device. And some years later, Wink realized what had happened to them and implemented a fee and had to email all of their customers who had had this for free up until that point, And there's an interesting affectation about the human condition, Mark, which is people behave weirdly if something they have been getting for free is taken away from them. If Wink had made it known in advance, it wouldn't have been a problem. But I think they had a lot of upset out of the customer base because that element of monetization was completely missing from the front. And not every consumer understands that having, you know, racks of servers or having things deployed in AWS to ensure that your mobile application works, to ensure that your hub can talk to the internet, comes with cost. So I think if they had implemented some design around usage-based monetization up front to create an ongoing fair value for money revenue stream to support application development and a furtherance of their technology, they could have been a real winner in that market. Unfortunately, they didn't initially and stumbled a little bit as they went. And the reason I cited this particular use case in the book is because I was actually a retail customer of theirs, and I really liked their device. I really liked their application. I really liked the way that it worked. And it was sad to see them misstep, perhaps, is the right word, because I liked the product. I liked the company. I wanted to see them succeed. And I was using what they had for sale, and I enjoyed it, and I felt I was getting good value out of it. But I think that's where they misstepped, was in the commercial design of the product at the beginning.
And by the way, good word, misstep. As I was listening to you, I was thinking of Clayton Christensen. You two would be so much on the same page on these case studies. Know thy customer and know the job that needs to be done for these customers. And I would just say that's the common denominator, at least from my reading of this, is know the customer, and that's going to help in backing into this usage-based model. Hey, this has been great. One last question that I want to ask you about your reading habits, if that's okay. Where does a company get started? We kind of have answered that question, but let me be overt with it. Okay, you've given me something to think about. Where do I get started? You've already talked about telemetry, but is there something even more fundamental than that in terms of, I think I need to make this move to a usage-based model?
I think there's a lot of reading you can do. There's a book that was gifted to me by an analyst that I found very interesting to sort of get to the next level of understanding the evolution of economics and going beyond usage, talking about crypto and decentralized currencies and other things that are starting to shape our, you know, perhaps next 100 years of economic positioning as a society. The Future of Money by Eswar Prasad, I think, is a great sort of next level book, learning more about how we perceive the value exchange in society, what are the different types of money in play today, which is increasingly important to look at given how inflation is affecting us all. And do you just leave things in sovereign fiat currency these days? Do you invest in crypto? Where is the best place to put it? What's going to happen as time goes by here? But that's a great next step to learn more about those economics and the different types of economics that are out there that could be impacted, because usage-based monetization doesn't just correlate to dollars. You could be monetizing using a variety of different types of money, if that makes sense as well, and learning a little bit about how those are evolving. The Future of Money was a good read on that one.
I can tell you are a reader. In fact, we were talking about Sean Silkoff before we hit record. Sean's been on the show before. I enjoyed it. Loved his book, Losing the Signal. And excellent book. Can I be nosy? Are you a reader? So what are some of your favorite books you like to recommend? You've already mentioned one, but tell me about some of your reading habits, if I may.
Yeah, certainly. I am a reader. I'll give another great nonfiction here. It's an older book, Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. Very yep. Interesting. I can see you nodding already. You've read that one. But understanding how your confluence of circumstance may shape your future and your evolution, either as a society or a company, a great read. Where I spend most of my time, and again, probably not a shocker here, given my heritage, is science fiction. And absolutely prolific consumer of space opera. Alistair Reynolds and his Revelation space series, Hugh can't recommend it enough. Ian Banks, of course, in the Culture novels, another great one. And I'll go back in time a little bit for one of the greats of all time, Douglas Adams, of course.
Just curious, he is also from Canada. I forget where exactly Canada is. He may be outside of Toronto, but we just had Cory Doctorow on a couple of weeks ago, who writes a lot of science fiction. Have you heard of him or read any of his books?
I haven't read any of Cory's books, but I tell you what, I'm going to go pick a couple of them up this afternoon.
I cannot thank you enough for participating in this conversation.
Well, I appreciate the kind words, Mark, and absolutely a pleasure to have an audience to talk more about this stuff, because as you can tell, I'm very passionate about it, and I think it will be the sort of topic that will be impacting us all increasingly over the next 10 years as we start to see this shift.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
Again, Adam Howitson, thank you very much. The book is The Usage Economy. And as we move into the final months of spring, I hope you keep pushing play. Some of the shows we have lined up include We Are Market Basket, one of the two best books I've ever read on the grocery industry. We'll soon be reviewing the book Shoe Dog through an FP&A perspective. And finally, we're going book club on the book The Effective Executive. And I can't wait to release our interview on the story of Jay Gould. The title is American Rascal. That's just a taste of what's to come as we head into the final weeks of the spring. We need to call this a wrap. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.